I never told no one that. My whole life I've been holding back. Every time I load my gun up so I can shoot for the stars, I hear a voice like, who do you think you are? Negative
thoughts come. All right, everybody, another day, another dollar, another one of my favorite podcasts. I'm biased, of course, it's my own podcast. What If It Did Work got with me. I mean, this guy's a hustler. Usually, I'm not gonna lie, usually people hire someone and outsource, oh, I've got a great person to have on your show, but you're a grinder, dude. That's why I know this is going to be a great episode. You gave me a copy of your book that we're going to promote. It's the one, the only, and I tried to do the Spanish version of his name. So I'll try to do the Italian version. Michael DeVellano.
Yeah, that's pretty damn good. Yeah.
Yeah, you see, dude, I was going to do the other L's. He's an author, podcast host, startup community curator. That's a big word, man. An experienced CTO and startup founder, an investor, including Ops AI and Cloud Advisory. He's also the author of Automate and Grow and has a side hustle. This is what I like. As a scout in major junior hockey, he's also a Husky owner. Oh, dude, that right there, you're a dog owner. You're a scout. You got it all, man. So talk to me, man. Are you a owner of like an ECNL team, or how does that work?
No, I'm not an owner at all. I'm originally from Canada, and when I was in Canada, I was, you know, I coached at different levels, just kept moving my way up. I was a manager, and then when I came to the States, I was actually out of hockey for like 4 years. So I scouted and I coached at a pretty high level, and I was actually a assistant general manager and then general manager at provincial junior. And then I was out for a while. I went to LA and I was like out for 4 years. My cousin is a pretty famous person in hockey. Unlike me, he's the now senior vice president, former general manager of the Detroit Red Wings, and he's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. And he was quite mad at me that I left Toronto, actually, originally. but that was always my inspiration. And then, you know, fast forward, I was living in Seattle area and not loving it. But there were two major junior hockey teams there. And major junior for people is like, it's the highest level of hockey in the world in the Canadian Hockey League. And it's 16 to 20 years old. So our guys get scouted to the NHL, basically, or like drafted to the NHL. But we draft players that are 14.
So yeah, sort of like soccer or
yeah, football. In a little yeah. bit. Soccer's got a club system. So mm-hmm. we have a draft and players don't have to come, you know, like especially American players tend to go NCAA a little bit. They wait. But you know, if you look at where the best players in the world come out of, they typically come out of Canada, and we're in the US division of the Canadian Hockey League. So I'm the US scout for a team called the Everett Silvertips in the WHL, which is the western part of the Canadian Hockey League.
Well, I have to ask you, you said you're Canadian and you're a capitalist.
I know. Why do you think I'm not there?
I was going to say.
The Maple Curtain, Omar. What are you talking
about? When you mentioned Canada and you mentioned Seattle and yet you're a capitalist, it's like, oh, it was like, boom.
Every bad idea in the States has come out of Seattle. So You guys are experiencing what we experienced living there for a while. So, and you know, I come from a pretty long, I don't know, I always had like entrepreneurial bent, and there's a lot of great companies that are actually, and a lot of great founders that are coming out of Canada right now, specifically in AI, but they leave. Like, and I don't know, but like Shopify.
It's socialistic?
Yeah, because it's a crazy, you know, overbearing government setup. I mean, it's just wacky and it gets worse and worse, you know, it doesn't get better. So it's, you know, it's sad watching what's going on there. Cause I think it's at an extreme level of what it's always been. And I was always like, I got to get to the States. It was always my dream to live in California. Now California is like Canada junior, you know, just trying to catch up. So now
we're about we're about the same age. And I always had these California dreams.
Yeah.
I have an aunt out there, so I would always visit.
Me too.
And it was like, like in the 80s and 90s, it was just like perfect, man. And I wanted to go out to college there. I wanted to move there. And now I still visit, and it's still beautiful, but it's
beautiful.
It's, it's still to me like, you know, paradise.
Yeah, it's pretty disappointing what's going on there. I mean, I don't know. It's a self-washing system, you know, like you got big bureaucracy and you've got, you know, the largest employers now are the university system, which has outlived its, you know, usefulness. Now it's almost harmful. There are some good schools there and good stuff happening, but, you know, it's a mess and they elect the government and it just goes back and forth.
Well, whenever people say they want more government, I point them to two things, California and the DMV.
Yeah. Well, that's what I listen, Omar, I think you're like, is your background Cuban? I can't remember.
No, I'm Colombian.
Colombian. Okay.
My ex-wife is Cuban. My kids are half Cuban. Well,
have you been to Cuba?
Have I been to Cuba? No.
I've been to Cuba.
Here in South Florida, Cubans.
Lots of Cubans.
You hear when they hear socialism or they hear more government, they run the other way.
Crazy. Like if you go to Cuba, it's the saddest place because everybody has it. First of all, they all have university education. That's mandatory. You go to university there. Second, you know, they're all underemployed and it's an underuse of amazing, beautiful assets. Right. So it's sad. And they have a saying there. It's called it's forbidden. It's forbidden for us, but you can do it.
they've got gun control there too, dude. No, allowed. So you see, whenever people are, you know, when they're like, we need to have zero guns out in the street.
Who's saying that?
people that think Greta is like.
But those are, you know what? I think, Omar, honestly, that this is a minority that have a loudspeaker. Because I've never talked to a single person that voted for Gavin Newsom. I mean,
really?
No, I've never met anybody that's, they all hate him. And it's like, wait, what's going on? How is this guy? I had someone explain to me for 40 minutes. He was a Mexican dude that came to fix something on my car. Like he was the tow truck guy. And he spent 40 minutes because he saw a sign in the front of my house. And in my house in California, I have a sign that says presidents are temporary and Wu-Tang is forever.
That's it. That is a true statement. Unless you're ODB. ODB is long gone.
What do we think? Yeah. What's funny is I voted, you know, I'm a new American, obviously. So the day I got, I became a U.S. citizen in the morning, you know, I got sworn in Anaheim. And at night, Trump got elected. And I was like, did I break the whole thing?
Isn't Anaheim, though, it's red, right? Orange County?
Orange County tends to be, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's like
Dallas in the middle of California in some ways.
Yeah. My aunt's from Laguna Hills, so that's
yeah, there why. You go.
Yeah, that's
maybe
why.
That's why I've never met anybody that voted for Gavin Newsom.
Exactly. You're like on a small island compared to the rest of SoCal.
So I know, you know, all the good things that came out of Canada were, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff, shockingly, that is coming out of there. Like I went to University of Waterloo. It's an incredible school and there's incredible entrepreneurial things that have come out of there. Shopify is a Canadian company of all things. It's in Ottawa, which is a terrible place to be an entrepreneur. It's the basis of government. It's like Washington, D.C. of Canada. So it's weird that, you know, they were there. Waterloo was, you know, so many companies that come out of there, so many breakthroughs would blow your mind. And there's stuff coming out of University of Toronto, Vancouver, but all those entrepreneurs want bigger opportunity, right? So they, in the end, you got to sell in the States and you got to sell internationally. And a lot of them leave, you know, there's definitely what we call a brain drain. There's always that fear, you know.
Did you come to the States because capitalism 101, wild, wild west when it comes to, you know,
of course. Yeah. I think there's way more opportunity in the US than anywhere in the world. Come to the US because of, you know, our view of the US was always like, hey, these are people that, you know, they're a little rough, but they take risk and there's outsized risk or reward for risk here. And that's what's so great about it. Right. And there's not this like tall poppy syndrome where, oh, that's not possible or that can't happen. It's the opposite. It's like you're, you know, what if it were possible is America. Like that's why everybody comes here that has any ambition, right?
Well, yeah, they come here for the American dream. Whenever somebody tells me It's dead. I'm like, are you? Excuse me, dude. If you open up the borders to every country, dude, we'd be like China. We'd have over a billion people crammed in here.
Yeah, for sure. And I think is coming from the outside. Like the good parts about being Canadian. I mean, I think you know it's a multicultural society instead of a melting pot. And mm-hmm. you know, not to get philosophical, but I think that's one interesting difference because when you're in Canada, you keep your cultural identity of where you come from. Like we know the difference between Italians and Portuguese, and we know the difference between like someone that's from like Senegal and Jamaica, you know, like you keep your identity. Like we know the inside Indian culture and Pakistani culture, those are not the same thing. And then inside of Indian, there's slivers, right? So I think that's a really interesting thing that we grew up with is a multicultural society where, yeah, you're Canadian, but you're also what you brought. And there's not like this thing where you divide up into gangs, right? Colors. Like, remember that movie Colors?
Of course, dude. I'm 50.
It's kind of like a metaphor, like black, white, Asian, Latino. Like, wait, there's other stuff in there you were missing, you know? So that was the good part, you know? And I think we did have pretty good education, like, no doubt. But there also is not necessarily that ambition. There's not like the upside. There's not a big market. There's a lot of, you know, if you look at the Canadian list of the top 20 companies in Canada versus the list in the US, and if you looked 30 years ago, they were probably very similar. If you look now, you know, it's the same list over here. It's banking, it's telecom, it's resources. If you look over here, it's like Google and Facebook and SAP and Oracle. And you've got like very transformational companies on this side in the US. So it's much more dynamic here. There's so much opportunity. There's an embrace of new, right? There's not a fear of new, like, oh, that's not possible. That's too expensive. It's risky if I make that the choice. And just that behavior. I mean, that's why everybody flocks here.
Now, here's my question to you. Your second book just came out, right?
Yes.
Form Your Own Pack. You share the story of a forgotten Japanese business model known as Kiritsu. I said that right, right?
Yeah, great, actually.
My minor's in history of modern Japan.
Is it? Okay, there we go. Perfect. That's one of us.
Yes, I got to ask you, where did you learn about this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we always had this, if you look back, like in the 80s and the 90s, there was a rivalry between the US and Japan, and it was in movies, it was in culture. You had all these great Japanese brands that really changed the landscape, and they sought opportunity and found success. Like, you know, Honda was not always the Honda it is today, right? Like Sony was an innovative brand. Like, so we always had that growing up. And the fable was the Kiritsu was this weird Japanese culture. And I think that I always had that. And what shocks me is how much, not just that, but let's say specifically that in this case, people forgotten. Like the stories of that have been lost. And so whenever I would ask people about if they understood what the Kiritsu was, they had no idea. And I think there were some just really valuable lessons. And that's really what inspired me to write Form Your Own Pack. And I think there's pluses and minuses that you, and I kind of highlight those. But I think the pluses for startups really are really interesting learnings. And that's why I wrote the book essentially was, let's reimagine the Kiritsu for startups.
Well, I'm sorry about that. It's funny, but since you weren't here, after we Rocky beat Ivan Drago and it brought down the Iron Curtain and, you know, no more USSR. Thank you, Sly. We needed a new enemy and it was Japan.
Which was weird. Yeah. Because they're pacifists.
Exactly.
But American creation, which is interesting.
Yes. Yes. Their military is us.
Yeah. Which is probably going to change.
The propaganda was for the longest time, was that they were going to come and eat our lunch.
Yep.
And that's why Gung Ho and all these.
Gung Ho, so you're hitting all these things, these cultural references, because if you remember that movie, Gung Ho, and it was like the clash of American factories that were shut down and the Japanese come back to this little town. It's Michael Keaton, right? And they're going to make little Japanese cars versus these big American cars. And, you know, what did they learn in the end? They're like, oh, you have this fanatical commitment to the company. We're not like that. We're working 9 to 5. We're union. We're going to go home. George Wentz can only do one job, you know? Like, and then at the end, they go, oh, we learned something from each other. And they make quality products, you know, like they have quality culture. They have a very fanatical approach that we can learn from. And I thought that was a great movie. It was great just for that lesson, really, I think, in a sense.
It was. Because it made it seem like the Japanese were cold, they're ruthless, they're 100% focused on the company, on the organization, on its goals. They come here and they soften up. Michael Keaton being the union leader and George Wang, and they come to a happy medium. It becomes like a they merge east and west to
create
this amazing company.
And you know, I've always been inspired in some ways also by Quentin Tarantino. And if you look at like one of my favorite, you know, two movies that he's made are Kill Bill. And he always described it as an Eastern meets a Western, right? So he had the first movie was like a, you know, an Eastern martial arts movie, and the second one was a Western, and together they tell that one story. And I always think that hybrid of culture is where you really learn. And that, in a sense, I think that's what Form Your Own Pack is about. It's saying, hey, let's learn from this fabled, you know, Japanese business model, which at its core is a model of cooperation between independent entities that have cross shareholdings. They meet every Friday, the CEOs and presidents of these giant corporations that we all know, like Mitsubishi, Matsushita, which is Panasonic, Sumitomo. They meet every Friday in lunch club and secret to have frank feedback. They look for ways to cooperate. They have these trading companies that open opportunities in new industries and new markets, and they assume risks, financial risks. And then they organize around common assets, right? So you're like, this is really interesting. And the result is, if you look at Japan, you're a student of it, unemployment in Japan never seems to rise above 2.5%. And there's a saying that Japanese businesses don't go bankrupt. And you're like, well, why? And it's because that culture and that structure. And so it was just really interesting to me. And I think there is downsides to it, which is you don't get rid of the bad wood sometimes. So there's, you know, there's no bloodletting of maybe poison inside your company or people that are lazy, you know, but although only Japanese people are lazy.
No, they're not lazy.
They're the opposite.
Culturally, I mean, it ever preschool up, it's all duty. It's all honor.
Exactly. For society. You're right.
There is no, I haven't even heard stories of them having Gen Z problems where, you know, screw it, you know, they haven't changed.
All
these years.
And that, you know, in some ways that's a bad thing, Omar, and I kind of point that out, which is one, Japan is very much, there's zero immigration to Japan. It's very,
I read that till this day. And if you do, you're a guy, and they treat you like crap.
Yeah, they're very, you're like second, right? You're not Japanese.
Like overt racism. If
for sure.
Immigrate and you're not Japanese. If you're from anywhere, not just if you're not born and bred and raised Japanese, even if you're another Asian, but not from Japan, you're ostracized.
You're second class. And what's the result of that is they are a dying society. So this country with like so many lessons to teach, with so much cultural influence, when you go to Tokyo, it's like stepping into the future. You're like, wow, this is what I imagine Blade Runner would be like. With ties to the historical past, the population is declining by now since COVID, 1.5 million people a year.
It's getting older.
It's the oldest population in the world. Mm-hmm. So there's cautionary tale in some of their culture, right? So I think what I say in the book is, let's learn the best parts of this and use it, and let's reimagine it for startups. And I liken it to a wolf pack, because I think that, you know, bureaucracy and large organizations, at some point you give innovation up for compliance or from conformity. And so what I say is like, well, let's reimagine for your startup. Why wouldn't we form, you know, our own pack of really three people in your pack. One is a mastermind of advisors and investors, a community of customers, and then partners, people that have aligned interest, whether it's cross shareholdings or affiliate partnerships or a common audience, but, you know, complementary products. You figure that out for yourself. Write that script for yourself and build with this in mind, because it's a model to scale. Like, you know, if you look at the example of, you know, crypto of the last 10 years, people are, what are the real lessons out of crypto? It's not that this is like a revolution. I mean, maybe there's something revolutionary about it as monetary value, but really they built a new concept of an organization. It's like these individuals that cooperated at scale, community and memes allowed them to get attention and grow and move markets, right? And I think those were the lessons that I took from it. And so I think that we can think of our own model and our own Keiretsu.
Now, you're talking common sense, though.
How dare you?
You make it sound so easy. It's but not. Yeah, why don't we follow that model? Why don't we do things in packs? You said it best. I mean, three packs that can innovate, especially a startup, and move. Usually, though, what happens, especially with startups, is the founders are looking for, a lot of them, a get-rich-quick scheme, the angel investors, or
maybe. I think I've been in that space for a while, and especially the last 3 years, I've really focused on building a community of pre-seed and seed stage startups and investors in those. And I provide like seven really specific in chapter three of the book, I think, examples of modern organizations that have achieved outside success. And I say, do they have any of the characteristics of the Keiretsu? And one of them is Y Combinator. And in Founders Pack, we have the Wolfcast newsletter and podcast, and we profile YC companies. Why? Because the real lesson from YC is it's not about the money. It's not about the quick exit. It's actually about community. And the story over and over from Y Combinator founders is, yes, they're the creme de la creme, but it's because they cooperate with one another. They bring each other customers. They cross promote each other. They help each other with problems just the way that Keiretsu does. And they don't even necessarily have cross shareholdings. They just do it because they're part of YC. So I think it's a phenomenal example of, you know, the craziest companies have come out of that, right? Like Airbnb and, you know, like Uber, and it's just crazy what's come out of there. And they can, the new batches would blow your mind. Like, and they're raising 5-10 million. Why? Because they're getting outside success, right? And they're not doing it by taking advantage of people. They're not doing it as a quick exit. It's because they have a culture, and part of it is cooperation.
Now, you're talking about real startups, though. I was talking about more of like the crowd, the crowdfunding, all those new. There was a phase a few years ago where for like if you invest in $10,000, we'll get you a drone, or you know, hey, $25,000. None of those companies, because I would look into. Yeah, I couldn't name you one publicly traded, publicly crowdsourced, where hey, let's raise money. Let's raise money for a film. Now I get it. There's a few with the few Christian movies that have come out, but
overall, I interviewed the one guy that did the film company. He crowdfunded and he's been very successful. If you look at the robotics company, Miso Robotics. They're revolutionizing restaurants, and they got big customers, and they've been all crowdfunded.
Really?
Yeah. And if you look in restaurants, there's a huge labor problem, especially since, you know,
of course,
lockdown, right? And so even like Chipotle, for example, has adopted their one robot arm and the whole system to manage it just to make chips. And because it's a job that, you know, no one really wants to do it, but it's very important. Like the chips are very important to the product. The next phase of that for Miso Robotics is it's chopping salad. And, you know, they think that they're going to do test kitchen or test stores where they'll see if it can assemble it the way you want it. So, and that's all crowdfunded, that company.
Bummer. There it goes to 50,000 minimum wage.
Well, you don't. Yeah. I mean, and Chipotle, you know, it's I don't want to get too much on Chipotle. I have a connection there. I think, you know, they're an interesting, they're innovative enough to adopt that, like, you know, mass customized product, and to incorporate a company like Miso is really interesting because of how they funded it. Like, it's really interesting.
Sorry, but don't worry. I've been putting it on pause. My coughing. It's allergies. It's not the Rona. Well, I'm not a super.
Whatever. Spoiler. That's fine. I think that's two.
So, but the Kuritsu.
Yeah.
Now, this is what I want to know is what really got you. Have you always had an interest in startups? Because pretty much you're involved in AI, which is, you know, growing up, you and I were always leery of Cyberdyne and Skynet.
We were praying for them to come, but I mean, I had a computer when I was 8 or 9. I don't know about you. And I actually, you know, I coded stuff when I was a kid in what are, you know, really basic, like, well, basic, literally in BASIC, in Logo, in early languages. My first computer was a Texas Instruments TI-99/4A. And I made a game.
Commodore 64.
And everybody had a Commodore 64, but I had the TI. I always had like this oddball thing always in all these examples. And that's one of them. Adam Coleco, you know, so I think growing up, it was always tech first and the earliest phases. And I was in the mobile space for a long time and an early slinging cell phones. And then I was always interested in mobile computing. I had a startup that I actually talk about in the book a little bit that was, you know, not necessarily a success because I was too early. And I kind of talk about, you know, projecting the future for your pack, that it's really important to be, you know, on mission. I think it's a lot easier to be aligned with technology trends now, as opposed to being too
now.
Now it's, you know, everything's kind of caught up. Like, but I tell the story of General Magic and my own startup that was in that similar space where we're just like 6-7 years too early, you know, like, but so I always had that. And then what happened was I was in the, you know, the wireless data space. I was in the BlackBerry world. And then when iPhone came out in 2007, I was like, wow, this is so much easier. And this concept of the app. So I was like, I'm going to go build everybody's app. So I went from doing what was really, really difficult because we didn't have mobile devices, we didn't have fast networks, and we didn't have an operating system and a development environment, to this thing that was like so simple by comparison to what we were building on. And I was like, wow. I kind of started my own practice, and I helped a lot of founders build either their SaaS or mobile apps, and came up with a really effective process for that over time. CTO for, you know, fractional CTO for startups. And then I also had a background in Salesforce. So that was really creating scalable cloud infrastructure to automate marketing, sales, and support. And that's kind of where my first book came out of. But through all of that, you're working with early stage companies and you're helping them build product, right? You're helping them build something that someone might or might not want. And it's gotten easier and easier to, you know, I talk about building the culture of your pack, and part of it is how do you address opportunity? And now you want to do it so fast. So I think all that learning and all that building, it's like, well, listen, rapidly prototype, go talk to real customers, go talk to real investors right away. And that's kind of got up at the ethos. So yeah, I've always been very interested in startups, and there's something painful about them, but there's also something romantic about them.
Well, with the technology, opportunity comes a lot quicker.
Totally. Yeah. In the book, I shout out to Van Latham because he was the first person to kind of clue me into this. I wrote early when I wrote this, and Van was one of the first people to read my book. I wrote, you know, our success as a species is based on our ability to cooperate and to use tools.
Yes, that's it from the very beginning.
Right. So, and then he says, you got to go read Sapiens. So if you read the book Sapiens, it just reinforced Yuval, I always pronounce his last name incorrectly, but Yuval Harari. I think that's the way you pronounce it. But his book Sapiens shows evolutionary wise, the success of the human species Homo sapiens is a result of their ability to cooperate in large numbers and use tools. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is what I was saying, right? But he did it, like he proved it. And he proved through empire after empire how this impacted the rise and fall of societies, which was really interesting. So I think it just reinforced, like, this is, you know, the use of tools and technology go hand in hand with our ability to cooperate.
Now, was there ever a moment, because on the outside, it looks like, man, you're a high risk taker. You're ahead of the curve. Looking back, all these were safe, were great bets. But at the time that you were doing them, it was like, whoa, dude, it was like you were at the blackjack table and you were splitting tens.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely a cautious side to me where I'm like, I want to make good choices, right? And I've made not bad choices. I think that concept of good and bad, like, and failure is a mistake, right? I think in general, if I think of why I came to the US, it's because there was at least a little different. It's not about A, Bs, and Cs. It's not about right, wrong, failure, success. It's, oh, here's opportunity. How do you attack it? And honestly, the biggest mistakes that I think we make in that system are we don't go after things aggressively enough. Because there are outsized rewards and people get jealous. There's a culture of envy and it's amplified right now where you look at someone's success and you try to explain it away. It's based on something other than the fact that they were willing to see a vision, go all in, put more and more resources in it, risk it all, go right to the edge. And that's the truth, right? Like, and that's where the system rewards. And there's this idea of there's some nepotism, and there's always nepotism, but I don't think that's innovative. I think it's things that are entrenched.
Beginning of time, man.
What's that?
Nepotism's been there. And yeah. That's like the third oldest profession behind, like, prostitution.
But if you think about where nepotism works is, you know, I have this, I always say nostalgia is an enemy, but bureaucracy insulates nostalgia. So like we can use these protective, defensive, nepotistic systems to protect things that aren't innovative, but innovative technologies and approaches will disintermediate those. They'll smash them. Like if you look at the, you know, the current Fortune 500, like that list is going to look very different in 10 years, probably.
It always does.
Correct. Yeah. Because there's creative destruction, right? So that means somebody else came in with this idea to disrupt what you're doing. Like if, you know, Google came in and gave away the Yellow Pages for free, buy Yellow Pages, you know, like all iPhone and all these guys came in and gave digital photography away for free. Okay, well, buy Kodak, you know, buy Polaroid. So it's just, that's the system, you know.
When you and I were growing up, we always applauded the innovators. We always saw them as heroes, as rock stars. Why has society turned and now we're like, oh, the Elon Musk, that we paint them now is the villain, the Jeff Bezos, all these guys, all they need is the monocle. Well, even Howard Schultz, guy wanted to run for president, but oh my gosh, a self-made billionaire. He must have hurt somebody with that coffee.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story offline about that. That's really weird. I think that because, you know, the upside of disintermediation of media, and I talk about in the book, like all companies are media companies and how to build in public to take advantage of that. The downside of that is don't read the comments because you're not the only one with a bullhorn. I've just, you know, I've seen that recently where it's like if someone with the wrong attitude and a lack of integrity or honesty and a zealousness for just an ideology reads something you write or watches something you build, they're going to inject their own story into it. And if the story is, oh, nothing's possible, you must have ripped somebody off to do this because they haven't tried or they don't do that and they don't have an innovative approach to things, that they might have a bullhorn And other people will coagulate to that because it seems righteous. But that, you know, in the end, that's not what creates greatness. Like, look at how bad, you know, how good is music these days or art? It feels very manufactured. And yet there are great artists out there.
It is very manufactured. They follow a formula.
Right. And that, you know, you have like The Voice and all this stuff. And, you know, we had, you don't have like punk. You don't have.
Well, rock is dead. Even though Nickelback, Canadian group, killed it.
Well, you guys like a lot of Canadian crap. So
I don't like Avril Lavigne and I don't like Nickelback. But when it comes to Canada, I Rush, and that's pretty much it. When it comes
Rush, to there you are. Yeah. Well, Drake. I mean, Drake's Canadian, so
that's other Americans. He might be
huge.
Making,
you know, shout out to Drake, like he built an empire, right? He's
never made a dollar off me, but yeah, it's correct. I forgot Drake is Canadian.
Everybody's Canadian. Name someone that you like is probably Canadian.
Oh, Ryan Reynolds,
Ryan Gosling,
Michael J. Fox,
Martin Short.
Yeah, Martin Short, you know, he's doing a podcast with Steve Martin, you know, Murder and the
is he?
Oh, no, it's a TV series called Murder.
Wow, that's crazy.
With Selena Gomez, too.
Yeah, you'd be shocked at. I mean, I think when people look down, you're like, damn, there's a lot of damn Canadians. What's going on?
Oh, there is, man.
We find each other everywhere, by the way.
Yeah, dude, for a country that's a lot of land and not heavily populated, you guys sure have a lot of celebs. Celine Dion.
True. And a lot of innovators, you know, I think it's like we had enough freedom to do stuff and then enough constraint that you knew you wanted to get the hell out. And there's doors. So they're like, oh, I got to go. Yeah. I forget what we were talking about, though. I think probably got sidetracked.
We were talking about just innovation. Here's one for you. Since I know you're an early adopter of AI, clearly it's a tool. Just like how Google was a tool, just how even Facebook, everything's such a tool. Why is it so polarizing? Why do we literally see a lot of people see it as literally Cyberdyne and Skynet just here to decimate and take everybody's job away?
Well, first of all, I think it's like an already useless media. So the people that are saying that are people that it can replace pretty easily because they're not doing anything innovative. They're just trying to stir up emotions and they figured that out. So that's one thing. They're the people that are going to get replaced first. Because if you look at, first of all, the companies you mentioned, like Facebook, LinkedIn, Amazon, Google, they've been using AI for like a decade. Okay. Like if you use YouTube, YouTube is 21 AIs. They have an AI that determines what thumbnails get shown. They have an AI that reads descriptions. They have another AI that creates transcriptions. There's an AI that has this feed. They have 21 AIs that make YouTube work. You think someone's sitting there managing YouTube? It's not how that works.
There's a room full of like four guys.
And we talk about algorithms. That is AI, right? So artificial intelligence has, you know, different aspects to it, like machine learning, natural language processing. What happened was OpenAI took two things that suck. Large language models are useless on their own to most people. Chatbots suck. Never been a good chatbot. And then they figured out you put them together and it makes a product. And so that product has, you know, impacted everybody's psyche, particularly writers, because I can tell it to write the article you just wrote. So that I think that's who it really threatens. I think the opportunity with AI is to, just like it was, you know, from 2010 when iPhone came out and then they had the App Store and they had the iOS development environment and Android had Google Play and they had, you know, Google bought Motorola and built their own devices, the Pixel, and, you know, Samsung innovated greatly, right? Now we have the Goop to make stuff. Same thing with SaaS. We've had a boom in software as a service over the last, you know, 13 years because the browser-based software was accessible and the tools to develop it were better and better. You know, you got Figma to design. You can rapidly prototype stuff for like 5, 10, 20 grand. You can build a product that used to cost millions, right? So that I think that's exactly what OpenAI has done, is they've made it so that we can all as developers take SaaS and apps to the next level. And that's really what's going on. Now, if your job is also replaceable by that, it's not as clean cut, but it is scary to people that you look and go, this thing, it seems like it's thinking. But what it does is it just has very fast access to a ton of information. It's consumed the internet, right? It's consumed, and now it's connected to the internet, right? Which is weird. That one's a little weird. So instead of searching on Google, you're finding on ChatGPT. ChatGPT is a product, but GPT and the APIs behind it will power all these other cool innovations. So now we can use that to interpret what you want. Right? You can tell me in plain language, instead of pushing buttons on a piece of software or on an app, what do you want? And I can have it interpret how to do the thing. It can code, right? It can make images. So these are building blocks to a new generation of opportunity. Like, that's really kind of exciting.
I mean, I see it as a tool.
It's a huge
tool. This is a guy that wrote two books. I'm not thinking, yeah. Oh my gosh, nobody will ever be able to write a book.
No, you'll hear more.
It's not, you know, because everybody goes to an extreme. Even the screenwriters, they act like you know, Universal Studios is going to be like, write me a screenplay with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's just going to spit out, you know, a $500 million blockbuster.
So here's the truth about that is they're also under threat because mass customization of video writing is now possible. And we're seeing some really interesting stuff where I'm trying to think of the one I just jumped on. It's called, why am I blanking on the name of it? But, you know, there's one that will create movies for you based upon your input.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And it works really well. Well, that, you know, that's a threat to actors who are already, you know, in a broken system. And studios who've been churning out formula-based products.
They've been doing the same thing over and over.
That's the problem, right? It's because it's like printing money for them, and it's a blockbuster, right? Gone are the artistic movies. Like, you know, Dog Day Afternoon, would that get made today?
No.
Right? Like, there's movies.
We've become, as a society, so risk-averse. Norman Lear just died. None of those characters. Yeah. I ain't married with children.
For sure.
If somebody looks at you the wrong way, then they're a racist.
That's crazy. So I think that, you know, that pendulum's going to swing, and the technology should be a part of it. Because what, you know, just like Spotify really gave opportunities to artists where, you know, before Spotify, you couldn't make a grand or two a month, or $5,000 a month, or $10,000 a month as just a small artist. You would have gatekeepers, and movie studios are like that, right? So movie studios are facing that down, and actors are threatened by it because the movie studios want to flip it on them. They don't like actors, right? Actors are difficult, like artists in general. So I think that's the reality. You know, the fact that you have unions involved, really, if you're an actor out there, just go make your own movie. That's all available to you. That's what music artists are doing, right? Build your own list, make your own album. Why? That's available to you to do that with movies now.
Yeah, but there's always been the outliers. That
right.
Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith with
really. Yeah. But we don't have those guys now, it feels like. But I think that's going to happen. I think now it's like, you don't have to worry about like going to the theater. Nobody goes to the theater. So someone's going to clue in, well, what's the Spotify of movies? Maybe Spotify becomes about movies.
Well, maybe we become more into artistic movies, which, yeah. You know, instead of
that'd be nice.
I saw a meme somewhere where Hallmark is on the verge of creating a second plot for its movies.
Really?
Well, because, you know, it's usually the old boy meets girl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, the old
variation on theme.
Cliche, yeah, just, you know, different set piece, same movie. Let's do it.
So I don't know. I think it's an opportunity, and there will always be people who are threatened by it. There will always be Luddites who will try to dig in and try to throw wrenches into the machine. And then there'll be people that try to take advantage of it to go at scale, right? Which are studios. And that's the threat to the people that are trying to live off of them. But I think the opportunity is there for whether it's movies or books or creating software. It's kind of democratized, right? And anyone that's threatened by that is going to, you know, try to guilt you or try to manipulate you into not doing it.
Now, with your book, Form Your Own Pack, who would clearly, this book would really 10X my stuff. I'm very up that word. I can't even say it right now. The opportunity, opportunistic.
Yeah, opportunistic, yeah.
Yeah, like, is this based on just the everyday entrepreneur, the mom and pop, or is this for somebody wanting to do a startup? To me, I read it, and being a business owner for 20 years, some of the tools in there, I could have scaled at a much quicker and faster rate if I would have done it with a pack.
Yeah, and I think that you don't even have to be in a startup to want your own, you know, group of trusted people or a community that you're either a part of or you grow. But I think definitely for startups, I think definitely for existing businesses, you can learn lessons from it, because I did, you know. And I think it would, for me, it was opening my mind and understanding, rather than being threatened by Amazon, being threatened by Google, being like intimidated by the fact that there's all these outside successes in Y Combinator and I'm not necessarily a part of it. No, let's learn from it. And I think that's what the opportunity is, because then if you look at those lessons, they're very applicable and they're not one size fits all. You can take it and build your own script, build your own community, build your own partnerships, build your own mastermind. It can look and feel the way you want. And that's kind of one of the themes of the book, which is I'm not giving you A, B, and C. I'm saying, here's frameworks. You can use it, make your own story. And so I think it's very applicable to anyone, definitely startups, definitely existing businesses. If you want to avoid being stuck in a bureaucratic system where you're following really tight rules, it's very useful.
So if you're out there in Canada, come on, move down to one of the 50 states. Move on down to the South.
What would be nice is if Canadians just took more risks, because it's not that scary. It's less, there's less downside now than ever, right? Just be, you know, look at your friends that are innovative, or make friends of people that are innovative. And because there are some great entrepreneurs out of Canada. You don't have to join the US. You can make your own success in Canada if you open your mind to that.
When there's a will, there's a way. There's capitalism everywhere. There's cap, dude. Yeah, if you can be capitalistic in China,
sure.
And there's capitalism in Cuba. There's
for sure there is. Elsewhere. For sure there is.
The human spirit. Yep. If you realize that you were designed for more, you want more, and you want to be more, government can put all the red tape, all the regulations. When there's a will, there's a way.
Yep, absolutely. I agree with you. I think that's why. And you mentioned other places, right? Like there's innovative stuff coming out of everywhere. I've dealt a lot with people in China. I have great relationships with business people in China. That's been a boom for, you know, 15, 20 years. And I mean, very good business people out of there, and they cooperate a lot, you know? So there's definitely things you can learn from different cultures, and definitely opportunity everywhere.
Well, you see, that's where my arts and science degree, that's actually worthless, you know, the study of other people.
You think that's worthless?
What? My degree? No, because I actually use it to help sell, like to study other people. Because a lot of times you just want to narrow people into our beliefs, which is a horrible way to sell. You know, you have to understand someone else's world. When you do that, you can connect. Now, if you're too busy, like some people on their social media platforms saying my way, you know, my political views are the best.
Yeah,
my
it's crazy.
Social views. Yeah. And it's like, dude, how are you going to sell to anybody if you're busy railing on 50% of the other people?
Yeah, dude. It's a waste of time. Like, I think I'm more interested in ideas and an idea is not, you know, one that everybody else has, right?
Well, anybody can destroy. It's a lot harder to create. But yet, you know, everybody takes the easier path. Everybody takes that path. Yeah. But yet, when their bank account sucks or they're busy inventing on the lucky people.
Yeah.
Dude, every action either pushes you towards making more money or being the person that you want to do, be, have more, dream more, or you can sit back and you know, be in your parents' basement, like railing against whomever and just hating on life, hating on capitalism, yeah. hating on the man that brought you down.
Well, I think you hit it in one head, which is, you know, like there's a real idea out there that nothing's affordable and I'll never own a home, for example, right? So, you know, it's crazy because it's like, well, where are you talking about? Because like, no, there's so many options in the US to go around. You have freedom of movement. You can pick so many different states that all different flavors and cultures and different real estate prices. And who says that when you're 25 or 30, why would you buy a single family home, for example? I always challenge people with that, like to say that, because I'm like, my first place was a duplex. I lived downstairs and I rented out. If I was doing it today, I'd buy a fourplex with three, you know, four three-bedroom units, and I would rent out two bedrooms in my units.
Look at that. You're the Canadian Grant Cardone, man.
Well, I mean, that's a crazy story too, the way he's gone from what he was
to a billionaire.
Yeah, like it's crazy. He was just very aggressive and went all in on,
but he's like you. That's not aggressive. Yes, it's aggressive, but betting on yourself,
yeah,
and betting on things that you know, that's the best risk. That to me, yes. On the outside, your choices, a lot of them, when you were telling me all that, yeah, that sounded risky at the time, but you also told me, growing up, you were big into coding. You were big into computing. You were always ahead of the game in technology. So it wasn't as risky as, you know.
Your mind.
Yeah. Well, the mind.
Perceived.
The mind. You said it best right there. Well, boomer, I can't afford a home.
Yeah, it's silly.
I want to. Boomer, you bought your house for $15,000. Good for you. You know, they don't understand that inflation, you know, they act like $15,000 in today's money. But, or, you know, why can't I live in Manhattan and own a penthouse, you know, at the age of
24? They're seeing the outcome.
As yeah, opposed dude, to, it's like.
And that's why I say I like ideas, because there's here's a challenge. How do you solve it? Right.
Exactly.
So it's like, so that's why I think of, you know, at no time were you ever able to start and build a TV station in the 80s. That would have taken tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Right. And there was only cable. But now anybody can start up a YouTube channel in a day.
Anybody can do, yeah. That's one.
Promote it and dude, Twitter and all these things.
AI is evil.
No, it's the best tool ever.
Yeah, dude. Completely. Completely. I've never railed against it. Everything that people are against, you can use it as a tool. I'm sorry. Facebook, yep. To me, man, if it was around 20 years ago where I could have been targeted ads instead of, you know, the print media that I had to do as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
People don't understand. Instead of being such a hater, it's like, yeah, man, these things are tools. Just totally. Because you use it in a way that you know, just because you want to post a picture of your hot dog that you ate or the pizza or the sushi, yeah, congratulations. Of course it's a waste of time. It's what do you do with your time?
So when I want to learn about something, I'm usually going to a younger person. That is actually, so yes, there, you know, maybe someone's writing, this is impossible and it's not possible. But when you get into the reality of it, there's someone there, the YouTube superstar is 15 or 18 that's figured out the algorithm, right? There's someone that's on Twitter that grew to 100, 200,000 followers over the pandemic because he and his buddies all decided that's what they were going to do and they're going to learn it and make it happen together. And they all grew their accounts at the same time. So for every cynical, closed-minded approach, there's someone else that takes advantage of that, and they're not thinking in groupthink. They're thinking either I'm going to do it or people that are in my pack, let's join together and work. And that's kind of, you know, a theme of what I've written about, which is challenge yourself to figure out how to make it happen. Now that's why I love, you know, your title, like, what if it did work? I mean, that's like,
because it's easy. You know what? We all have the tools for success.
Yep.
But we always focus on the reasons why we suck, or that's why easy. Someone's holding us down, or why it can't work. You know, yeah. or we think that we need to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to someone to answer. No, man, just friggin' do it. That's
it's interesting you say that, because like I find that whenever I've gotten, and you know, we get into these mental models, right? And I've written two books for me. Right. I wrote one book to codify what I was going on in my head to solve problems inside of businesses with technology, which is, well, how do I always have a good outcome with technology? Well, because I think in this way. And so I shared that blueprint, right? That's automate and grow. And then now with Form Your Own Pack, it's the same thing. I wrote it for me, which is to say, should I compete? Should I be a lone wolf? No, you succeed by having at least, you know, these three packs. And open your mind to the using tools to amplify those packs. And that's really kind of, in a sense, why I wrote this.
Now, I can talk to you because great minds connect. But being in a TikTok society, if it goes over.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of clips out of this.
Yeah, definitely. A couple of things.
Yeah.
I'm part of your newsletter, which I get.
Oh, good.
So how do people get your newsletter? How do people listen to your podcast, because I know you're a podcaster.
Yeah.
And more importantly, how do they buy your book?
All wonderful questions. So this is what it looks like, if you can see it. Oh, geez. I might have to, like, there we go.
There you go.
It's on Amazon. You can go to Amazon, just search for Form Your Own Pack, Michael Devolano. I think the paperback's like $14.95 or something. There is a hardcover coming. I think it's like $25. Or if you're Kindle Unlimited, you can get it for $0 if you do a subscription. Founders Pack is our community of, you know, pre-seed and seed stage startups and investors. So founderspack.io. We run pitch events, we run in-person events, dinners for founders. And then the Wolfcast is our newsletter/podcast. It was originally called Form Your Own Pack, but we called it the Wolfcast because we kept writing, not just doing interviews. So it's kind of a combination. Sometimes we'll do interviews with founders or investors, and there's a video with an article. You can get that from founderspack.io, or we actually publish on Beehive. So you can't get it on Spotify or anything. You have to go to thefounderspack.beehive, BEEHIIV.com. And Beehive's the booming newsletter platform. It's really interesting what's going on there. Tyler Denk and their team. And yeah, you can be a free subscriber, or you can join Founders Pack as a paid member, and we do monthly AMAs. So we bring in experts on different growth topics, everything from sales to cold email to SEO to, you know, growth hacking. And that's probably the best way. So yeah, founderspack.io, Amazon, hit me up. I'm happy to talk to you on Twitter as well. The Founders Pack.
And one final question, Michael.
Yeah, sure.
Any parting words of wisdom for those that wanting to be the loner, wanting to do it all, you know, they're the entrepreneur, the solopreneur. Do you have any words of wisdom on the pack, on becoming part of a pack?
So there's this romantic notion that like a lone wolf is the one that solves, you know, technical problems, creates companies. But if you really drive down, and even just, you know, wolf packs themselves provide a great example. About 15% of wolves become lone wolves, but they struggle. They struggle out in the wild against bigger prey. But if you look at a pack, it's actually a family. So people think there's an alpha and it dominates all the other wolves, but that's not actually what a pack is. If you look at the research, the idea of a lone wolf and the idea of an alpha were animals in captivity. So the more constraints they had and they were caged in, they behaved erratically. But in the wild, a pack is basically two alphas. It's a mother and a father and a bunch of pups. And the pups will leave and start their own packs. And that's the way I encourage people to approach life, because a wolf pack can take down much bigger prey than any individual wolf. And I think that's the opportunity you have by forming your own pack.
Awesome. Michael, thank you. Thank you for hunting me down. Thank you for letting me read the book. Thank you for letting me spend an hour just getting to know more about everything, man. And, you know, I honestly don't believe Cyberdyne or Skynet will destroy us. There'll be other things, maybe Greta.
We'll merge, like everything else, we'll merge.
Exactly. All righty, brother. Thanks, you.
Man.
And have an outstanding rest of your night. 2024 is the year of positive change in technology. All righty, thanks, man.
Thanks, Omar. I'm thinking like, what if it did work? What if you took action and made it happen and started living inside of your purpose? What if it did work? Right now you can make the choice to never listen to that negative voice no more. The hardest prison to escape is our own mind. I was trapped inside that prison for a long time. To make it happen, you gotta take action. Just imagine, what if it did work?